So with that, I think we're getting ready to kick off today's session. Today's speaker will be joined by Steve Diamond, who's going to address some questions from last week's session. But our primary speaker today is Dina Crumbling from our office here in the Technology Innovation Program. Dina has actually been working here at the EPA for how many years now, Dina?
11 years
with the Technology Innovation Program. And has 20-plus years as an experienced analytical chemist in a wide variety of situations. She's been in the hazardous waste arena for over 15 years. Within TIP, though, she's focused on supporting the acceptance of field analytical methods and improving the quality of hazardous site characterization through systematic planning and adequate QA/QC procedures. She coordinates with a lot of EPA offices, regions, states, and other government agencies to try to help provide scientifically sound guidance and information to encourage defensible site decision-making. We will also be joined by Bob Johnson from Argonne National Lab. So with that, I will again remind everyone to start on slide number one and turn things over to our speakers today. Oh, yes, and I will. I think we will move forward to slide number two and slide number three, where we will cover any questions from last session on representativeness. And the question that we had submitted from the session number two is the following. Do you know of any large-scale lead sites where EPA has made removal and or remedial decisions based on the concepts discussed, in parentheses, sample and decision support? We have not observed EPA scientists and decision-makers in our region using these concepts of sample representativeness in making decisions at residential properties on large-scale lead sites. State regulators and private sector consultants can find it difficult to implement these concepts when EPA's own scientists are not yet doing this. Does EPA have any strategies for integrating these concepts into decision-making within the agency?
This is Dina. I personally know of or have heard about some selected projects in the RCRA program and brownfield, few in Superfund, military bases, explosive sites in particular. There was a project in Hawaii that did a good job with this. So there are scattered instances where people are beginning to include these concepts in their project planning and implementation, at least to various degrees. But it's still an uphill battle getting these concepts included. Part of the issue is a lack of awareness, especially among less technical people like managers or policy people, regulation writers, and lawyers. Among technical people, I think there is a greater awareness of the problem because you're pretty much faced with it every day if you work with soil samples or the data. But there's never really been a good feasible way to deal with it, either from the standpoint of having the techniques or the equipment or from a cost standpoint. So I think it's been like the elephant in the living room where everybody knows it's there, but if we ignore it, don't talk about it openly, we can pretend that it's not there. What we are doing in my office is saying that, okay, we actually have ways to deal with this problem now. We can make it okay to talk about the elephant. We can talk about data uncertainty because we do have ways to cope, and the techniques are affordable. They make projects run so much better. Technically, it's not all that difficult, but it requires a different mindset than what people are used to, and it requires an openness to change. As you probably all know, regulatory-driven activities are not all that amenable to change. But change will have to happen eventually. We have too much history with remedial designs that don't work in order to bury our heads in the sand and pretend like everything's hunky-dory when we have plenty of evidence that it's not. I think one of the biggest catalysts for change is legal challenge. I've had lawyers sit through some of these classes and when we give them in classrooms, and they've said they found this information enlightening. When there's legal challenges to data based on data representativeness, then change will probably happen much faster at a programmatic level than it is right now. But until that happens, I think change will happen only slowly, basically one project at a time or one project manager at a time. So that's where we are at this point, is getting that education out and trying to educate people about what the possibilities are.
Steve, did you have anything to add?
I think, this is Steve Diamond. I'm in the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology and Innovation in the Technology Innovation Field Services Division with Dina and Gene. And I guess my two cents, thanks for starting us off with such a lovely question, but it is a big question, and I was hoping we'd keep things on a technical basis, but there are a lot of policy implications for the types of things that we're going to discuss throughout this course, and stimulating that conversation I think is good. But the quick answer to the question, as Dina mentioned, is yes, there are sites that have embraced and utilized the concepts and the strategies that we teach in this course. But we also recognize that there's a variability as to how EPA regions and states can apply these principles. As I mentioned, there are policy issues, funding, programmatic, and a host of other things that go along with implementing these. So there's a lot of variability in that respect. But for our part, what we're trying to do within our branch, we've tried to highlight the issues that we've encountered through tech support activities by doing things like writing case studies and profiles, developing some of the tools that I'll be talking about in DMA and QC modules, the two subsequent modules from today's, looking at strategies to try to deal with some of these issues, teaching courses to regions and states and folks like you guys on the phone today, live and via internet platforms, and just trying to engage end data users, folks like risk assessors, and engaging the policymakers as well. Unfortunately for us, we're a little bit limited, somewhat limited to what I'd say call a bottom-up approach, meaning that we seem to have the most success using a bottom-up approach that is one tech support site at a time. We have had attempts to apply more top-down approaches, and those have been met with some resistance. And honestly, we have somewhat limited influence on the development and implementation of regional and state policies or procedures. So our hands are tied a little bit there in terms of, states and regions are more than entitled to develop their own policies and guidances with respect to some of these things. So, but what we're left with is really continued efforts to try to highlight why we think these issues are important, show you where conventional approaches have led to either inconsistencies or what we view as issues. And as you can imagine, there aren't exactly folks lining up to volunteer for this, so we have to go out and kind of find some of those issues and inconsistencies that we see in various programs. And then we try to show the benefits of how doing things slightly differently through approaches like Triad and the use of field analytics like XRF, the use of dynamic work strategies and the like can provide a benefit to your program, to your site, and as Dina mentioned, without getting too excessive in terms of cost and some other things. So that's where we're at this time. I'm going to go ahead now.
Yeah, I think we can go back to the seminar. This is Gene. Just a gentle reminder, if you're joining us on the phone lines, please mute your phone lines by pressing *6. I can hear some background noise. *6 to mute, and when we're ready, *6 to unmute. Thank you. With that, I'd ask everyone to move on to slide number 4. We'll begin today's session.
Actually, let's go to slide number 5. I'm going to review a little bit from last week with a quote that we also saw last week, that a representative sample is one that answers a question about a population with a given confidence. And the second quote is, a sample that is representative for a specific question is most likely not representative for a different question. How I think this really applies is when folks write QAPs, it's really easy to use the phrase, we're going to collect representative samples. Or you see sentences a lot like, representative samples will be taken. And that's kind of a lazy man's way, because they never have to be held to account for, well, representative of what? And I think one of the things we can do when we're writing PLAPS is use language like samples will be representative of dot, dot, dot. And don't say representative of the site. The site contains lots of things, a lot of different populations. You know, you have clean areas, dirty areas, areas where there were spills versus areas with atmospheric deposition. Those are all different populations. The site also contains buildings, trees, pavement, asphalt. So representative of the site really doesn't tell you anything. So if you use the language, the representative of, it forces you to be specific, such as representative of a quarter acre of a yard to a six-inch depth. Or especially when you first start planning, there might be a lot of questions you have to deal with, so sometimes it's easier as placeholders to say just representative of a risk decision or representative of the lead exposure pathway. And then as project planning progresses, you'll be able to fill in the details with the actual decision support and sample supports. So people that review work plans or review QAPs can start making notations, questioning any language that just says representative samples without providing any specifics. Going to slide number 6. Ken's review from last week, sample support is the foundation of sample representativeness. And sample support, again, refers to those spatial dimensions of a sample, the depth, area, as 3D dimensions, other physical attributes that are important to determine the concentration of a sample, such as particle size, may also be important to control. If you're trying to split samples to compare two different methods, you must absolutely control the sample support, or you're literally sending two different samples off to different laboratories, and you really can't expect the results to match. Going on to slide number 7. I'm going to go through a fictional example of the sample support chain, from decision support to sample support. And this is a fictional example. I made it up, sort of pulled from different experiences and simplified some things to sort of get at the concepts. Don't try to make this a real project or exact on everything, because it's not. It's just to illustrate the points. So the first thing you want to do in a project, step one, is always to understand what decisions you're trying to make, and then understand the decision support. And that decision support is the volume over which you're going to be making that decision. So in our little example here, first of all, our project decision is to determine the average concentration of a fictional metal analyte, I'll just call it ME, over a decision unit that's being defined according to the data needs of an eco-risk assessor. Now, the eco-risk assessor has defined the decision unit as an exposure unit, and the exposure unit dimensions are the soil that are encompassed by a one-acre area to a one-foot depth. The relevant eco-receptors are assumed to be equally exposed to all soil particle sizes. Okay, so from the decisions unit, we can derive the decision support, which is very simply a one-acre soil area to a one-foot depth in the third dimension. And the total metal concentration will be for the bulk sample, since in the bullet above, we assume that they will be equally exposed to all soil particle sizes. So the exposure point concentration will be calculated over this decision support. Move on to slide 8. We get to step 2 of our fictional example. Now, at this step, we're going to determine the desired degree of data confidence and develop the preliminary conceptual site model. So for the degree of data confidence, the risk assessor tells us that they would like to have a 95% upper confidence limit for the exposure unit and have that number within 10% of the calculated mean. So this is an indication of how close they want the UCL to the calculated mean. And we'll get to that a little more a little later. If that doesn't seem real specific right now, it'll become more specific later. Now, our preliminary CSM is that this sectional metal was released to our exposure unit about 10 years ago when a nearby lagoon from an industrial process overflowed into this flat meadow area. So at a macro scale, we expect the distribution to be reasonably homogeneous or even because of this flat meadow area. Now, an initial guesstimate of the true mean is in the vicinity of 300 to 400. And we base that guesstimate on knowledge that we have of a similar release from a similar lagoon at a processing plant that was in a different location. So it was a different processing plant, but it was the same scenario. Move on to slide number 9. Now, step 3, we're going to start considering the sample support. We know that the sample support has to mimic the decision support for the targeted population. And for the 12-inch depth, it's going to equal, the sample support depth is going to equal the population's depth to the foot. Now, area-wise, obviously we can't take a sample of an acre in order to send to the lab. What we have to do is take small samples. So we have to select the diameter of the sample support. And that is going to be balanced against the number of samples that we need to control data variability. So for this example, we know that one dimension is depth, and that's to 12 inches. But for the area dimensions, how wide of a sample we need to take, we have to figure out. Now, we may have prior data that would help us do that. For the sake of this example, I'm going to go through an illustration of using a small pilot study to figure out what our optimal sample support is. Moving on to slide number 10. Continuing in step 3, we're going to look at controlling microscale variability. Now, that microscale variability is that which is occurring within the size of the sample, the sample in a jar. At this point, for this matrix, we don't know how much microheterogeneity is there. We do know that it costs more to process larger sample masses than smaller ones, because you have to not only collect a larger sample mass, but you're going to have to do more work to handle it so that any subsamples taken are representative of the initial larger mass. So that may mean some sort of crushing of the samples or subsampling using a G-based theory. Pierre G, I think he was French, last name G-Y, developed theory to aid the mining industry on looking at how to take representative samples when you're dealing with very heterogeneous materials like ores. And EPA actually does have guidance that discusses using the G theory, and I do have websites in here, and we're also going to post that to the Fluen website as well, so you can easily access that guidance. Now, we're going to figure out when we do sample prep, we're going to see how adequate it is by running a triplicate lab split on a site sample that is the most difficult to crush into a uniform appearance. And crushing could be with a mortar and pestle, say, out in the field. We're not going to try to grind it, but just crushing it and see how uniform it appears. If the triplicate subsamples exceed the between sample variability, I'm going to get to explaining this in the next slide, which is a graphic, then we're going to have to take additional sample preparation procedures. Let's just go on to slide 11. Basically, what you should see here is a yellow three-dimensional plane, which represents our decision support. And then we have five sets of sample supports. Each of the five sets has a smaller diameter sample support, and each has a larger diameter sample support. We're interested in two things. One is, what is the variability across that area? So each of those five samples are scattered across the area randomly, and we want to find out from those what kind of variability we're seeing across decision unit itself. Then, within each of those sets, we want to look at how much variability is there if we take subsamples. If we look at the smaller diameter sample, we take three triplicate subsamples and analyze those and see how much variability there is. And we'd look at the large volume sample support and take triplicate subsamples and analyze those and see how much variability there is in the larger sample support. And we don't want to do triplicates on all of them, so we're only going to do triplicates on the one that looks like it's the most difficult, so we get a worst-case scenario. The table there, again, shows some fictional data, just for the purposes of explaining how this works. For our small sample support set, the standard deviation for the small samples is 90. The standard deviation when we use the large samples is only 20. When we did the within-sample triplicates after sample prep, we had a standard deviation of only 10. 10 is the smallest of those numbers. So that is actually a minor contributor. Once we have the sample that's been crushed, the microheterogeneity is pretty well controlled. That's what it's telling us. When we take the entire sample support for a small sample and crush it, and then look at the variability between small sample number one, small sample number two, number three, and number four, and number five, and you crunch those five data points, you get the standard deviation of 90. So that 90 contains the variability that you get with using a small sample support over that decision unit. Now, the larger sample support is able to cover more of that area, obviously, because it's a larger sample support. And if we do the same analysis, we crush that larger sample support and then analyze it, we find that the standard deviation is only 20 because those larger sample supports help minimize the between sample variability, where you have like co-located samples. The larger sample support helps minimize that type of very short scale co-located sample variability. Now, what's the impact of that? Well, that's the second line in that chart. Based on the standard deviation of 90, you would have to take 20 small samples, small support samples, in order to get the decision confidence that the risk assessor wants to get. But because the larger sample support data set has a lower standard deviation of only 20, once you run those numbers, that means you only need 4 samples. Okay. How about if we open phone lines of questions so far? I know that might be kind of hard to digest.
Okay. Again, if you are on the phone lines and you have a question, you can press #6 to unmute your phone line. Feel free to speak up, state your name or your location, and ask a question if you have one.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. This is Jim Wolf. I have a question. Just to summarize this last slide, the conclusion of this pilot study would be that you'd be best off using a large sample support, and your crushing technique is just fine.
Yes.
Okay.
We also have a question that, thank you for that, a question that came in online from Massachusetts, and they ask, how were the number of samples determined in slide 11?
So this is a pilot study. So it's an early study to try to get a handle on how many samples do we need to take for the real study so that we can get enough data right off the bat to make our decision. So we don't want to take too much, more data than we need, but we want enough data to make our decision. So that's the purpose of this pilot study. And 5 is a reasonably good number to do some statistics on. Obviously, for statistical purposes, the more samples you have, the better. But when you're just doing a pilot, 5 or 7 is a reasonable number, especially when it's a pretty small area that you're covering.
If you have a question on the phone line, go ahead and speak up. #6 will unmute your phone line anytime. Okay.
Okay.
So we actually have 2 more that came in. This is to clarify the previous question from Massachusetts. How is N equal 20 or N equal to 4 determined?
The statistical equation. For, actually, you can do this in VSP. Probably that's the easiest way. The visual sample plan, which a lot of people are aware of, it's a software that was developed with DOE and I think DOD and EPA funding support. It's free. It can be downloaded from the web. And in your notes, again, you'll have the URL. It'll run those numbers for you. And I do also in the notes, if you get the PDF file, in the notes you will see additional discussion about how those numbers are calculated.
There's another question from Maryland. Is there a specific regulatory set of equations to use to determine the numbers of samples that are best over a given area?
No.
Okay. Excellent.
And there shouldn't be.
If there are no more questions on the phone line, we can go ahead and continue. If you have unmuted your phone line, you can mute it again by pressing *6.
So going on to slide 12, we'll continue this fictional example. Step 4, now we're going to look at going from the large sample support to analysis. In other words, we're going to go from sample support to subsample support. Obviously, these field samples that we're taking, I didn't try to assign an exact volume to them, but they're going to be very large compared to the mass of soil that would be digested for metal analysis, either if you're going to analyze it by, say, ICP or AA, which require digestions. Generally, the mass of soil digested for ICP is somewhere between 0.5 gram to 2 grams. A lot of labs use 1 gram, but I've heard some that say they use 0.5 gram and others that go up to 2 grams. But still, it's a pretty small mass of soil. So the mass of soil that actually gets digested in the acid that small amount of soil, we could call it the subsample support or the analytical sample support. Again, that's that very small amount of mass that gets dropped into the acid and cooked to release the metals into solution. So the question is, how do we go from this very large field sample, which, you know, who knows, maybe it's a kilogram, how do we go from that down to 1 gram? And how do we do it in a representative way? And in this case, representativeness means that every part of that large sample that we took, every particle has to have an equal probability of showing up in your analytical sample. So we don't want to select for or against certain particle sizes. We have said that this large sample, this bulk sample, is our sample support. It is what we want an average over for this large sample. So how do we get from there? Well, again, you can see this 2003 EPA subsampling guidance that discusses it in more detail, but I'm going to run through an option for how to do it based on some project that I did, and I took some pictures along the way. So we can go on to slide 13. There's two general ways that you can do this. One is you can take the entire large sample and grind the whole thing to uniform particle sizes. I have been reassured that some laboratories do have the equipment to do that, but not all laboratories have grinders of any size. Sometimes the only grinder that's available, if any is available, is one that's pretty small that'll handle like maybe 25 grams at a time. But the equipment is out there. Certain labs have it. But it is possible that you'll find it difficult to find a laboratory that can give you that. The other option is to use this sheet-based sample handling to progressively subsample in a representative way so that you can get down to a mass of sample that is more easily handled for grinding. And you want to be grinding this because you want a uniform particle size so that each particle has an equal chance of being selected. Let's go on to slide 14. And these are photos of a project. This actually was about a 1 kilogram sample. It was crushed from the standpoint of breaking up the aggregates. You can still see that there is a fair amount of particle size differences, though. So the scoop has to be of the right dimensions so that it is able to representatively gather all those different particle sizes. In effect, the largest particle size is not going to be excluded from the scoop because the scoop is too small, and a larger particle size would get pushed to the side or would fall off. So we have there the flat bottom scoop, and it's large enough so that all particle sizes are easily scooped up in it. The next picture on the right shows that 3 scoops were taken out of that 1 kilogram sample, trying to go down to the bottom and scoop through the entire thickness. Go to the next picture, slide number 15. Then what was done is those 3 scoops were, and it's hard to describe this in words, but basically you dump them out a little at a time in a line. So you go back and forth dumping out the soil so that it's as evenly distributed in that line as you can. So you take one and dribble it out across the length of the tray. You take the other one, the next scoop of the 3, and dribble that And then the third, again, you dribble it over, continuing going back and forth over that line so that you get an even distribution of all the particle sizes. The next thing you do is use your flat bottom scoop again, and you scoop across perpendicular to that, and you take several scoops so that, in effect, you're reducing the size of your sample. As you take each scoop, you put it into a beaker or other container, and let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, it took 5 scoops across, and they all went into the same beaker. If you needed to, you could do that again in order to reduce the volume again by about a half or whatever, till you get down to a volume that's easy to grind. Because you have to grind because you need to get down to a particle size that's going to let you take those very small sample supports that you're going to use for analysis. If you're only going to take 1 gram, you're going to have a pretty uniform particle size so that you don't select against larger particle sizes when you're taking that 1 gram subsample. Grinders. Let's go on to page 16. The grinder that I had available was a ball mill. You see the inside of the ball mill there, and there's the cartridge is inserted. Basically, a ball mill is this metal cartridge, and there's 2 sort of like steel ball bearings that go in with your soil sample, and you screw the cap down, and you put it in this thing, and it shakes it. And the balls bang against the particle sizes and try to, you know, reduce the particle sizes. These ball mills work pretty good for things that you can break up easily. This was a very clayey soil, so it was hard in the sense that once you dried it, it was like a little brick. But the actual particle sizes, because they're clays, are actually very small. So once you broke up the aggregated little bricks, the actual particle size are pretty small. So the ball mill worked pretty well. But a ring and puck mill, I've been told by experts in this field, is actually much better because it can actually grind up little pebbles and things. A ball mill isn't going to do that very well. But a ring and puck mill can actually take the little pebbles and sand and grind it all up to a uniform particle size. And it works better if you can get a hold of one. Move on to the next slide, which is 17. And on the left side, there's a picture of when you open the ball mill, and you can see the clay soil's been ground. It's a pretty small size. Basically, these clays are aggregates of particles that are pretty small once you break them up. I also worked on pounding the clays in a mortar and pestle. And I don't know if you can tell from the figures, but obviously the ball mill is able to grind it to a smaller particle size than I was able to do in a mortar and pestle. But again, you have to remember that the particle size you need is related to how you're going to subsample it for analysis. And the larger the volume that you're going to sample for analysis, the larger the volume or mass that you can put into your analysis, then the less important it is to reduce these things to dust. It's all about having a good uniform particle size that your sampling technique can equally subsample all of the particles equally without selecting against any of them. Let's open up for questions at this point.
Again, if you're on the phone lines, you can press #6 to unmute your phone. If you have any questions for Dina, feel free to speak up and state your name or location. Anyone who's streaming the audio online, just a gentle reminder, you can use that question mark icon to fill out the online question submission form at any time. You don't have to wait until Q&A breaks. You can submit them, and we'll hang on to them until the next question break. We do have a remainder or residual question from the last break. And while we're waiting, in case anyone is formulating a question now, this is from Denver, Colorado. And they were asking if the DST, and it's actually V as in Victor, S as in Sam, P as in Peter, VST, site sampling software assume a normal distribution for contaminants?
Two answers. For the equations in VSP that I used in this project, the answer is yes. And that'll actually hold in this example because I am subsampling from a something that I can feel pretty sure is uniform because of the way I am preparing the samples. There's also the ability in VSP in some of the modules to say that you want a normal distribution or a non-normal distribution, and it will give you a different program depending on which you select. Deciding whether you can use a normal distribution or should use a non-normal distribution when selecting the right equations is extremely important. So this is a very good question. You have to be able to argue that for the work you were doing at that time, it is reasonable to assume a normal distribution, or you have enough data to show that you have a normal distribution.
Looks like we had another question that came in, submitted online, and this is from Massachusetts. Do you sieve to assess the ground sample homogeneity?
Yes, I did. I didn't have a mechanical shaker, but I did do it by hand just to see if any things were being really left behind, and it was reasonable for what I was doing, so the particle size that I want, I was getting.
Anyone on the phone lines have a question? Go ahead and speak up. Okay, I don't hear anyone on the phone lines, and I don't see any more coming in online, so Dina, feel free.
Okay, going on to slide 18. We have to remember is that this idea of measurement support that we talked about last week, that an analytical instrument can only see what is presented to it. For an ICP, it means it can only see what's injected into it in liquid form, because what you inject into it is the liquid digest of the soil sample. For an XRF, it sees only what's in the view of its window when you shoot it. When you do your analytical sample preparation, you also have to be careful to consider whether the digestion or extraction method is appropriate or representative of the parameter of interest. If you're, say, going to an extraction for SVOCs and your extraction process either does not get the SVOC of interest out or destroys it in the process, you need a different analytical sample preparation method because it is not getting at your parameter of interest. It's not appropriate. One thing to keep in mind is that ICP metals analysis does not always report total metals. Digestion with the nitric acid doesn't solubilize all of the mineral matrix, and some of your soils may be bound up in the mineral matrix. So digestion with nitric acid doesn't always get all the metals out of that soil sample, out of that 1 gram soil that's been put into the acid. It doesn't always get them into solution so that it gets injected into the ICP. And certain metals recover really poorly. Antimony is one of them that you often see very high detection limits for it because it just does not do well at all in that kind of acid digestion. You can go on to the next slide, which is 19. So, quick review of where we are so far. We need to control sample support. And by controlling sample support, we can reduce the within-sample heterogeneity, which is at that micro scale, that within-the-jar scale. and sample support can reduce the between sample heterogeneity, especially between sample where you've got short distances, like co-located distances, where one grab sample 2 feet away is completely different than another grab sample that's only, again, 2 feet between the two of them. Taking a larger sample support really helps reduce that. But then it means that you've got to mix and homogenize that sample support. And there's ways to do it, dealing with large samples, but it takes learning a few techniques, but it can be done. The benefits are that you will get greatly improved data quality. Your data variability will decrease. You'll have much reduced incidence of those outlier data results that don't seem to make any sense, and typically they sort of get thrown out. You do a statistical test and says there is an outlier, so you toss them out. And that's really not a great idea, so we'd like to reduce the instances of throwing out data because it doesn't suit us. But you have to really, really control that sample support. And quality control is a mechanism to estimate how much variability is being caused by the various aspects of sample support. Go to slide 20, and we'll do a review of those supports that we've talked about. There's the decision unit support, which is the spatial dimensions and other physical properties that define your population of interest to your decision. The sample support is the spatial dimensions and physical properties of the physical sample. And to the greatest extent possible, it needs to mirror the decision support. And then measurement support is the dimensions or mass of that analytical sample that's being digested or extracted so that the instrument can actually see it and measure it. You can go on to the next slide, which is slide 21. At this point, you're probably wondering, why do we need to understand all of this? Well, it's because XRF analytical programs perform much, much, much better when you control these variables in an XRF study. All these supports are very relevant to using XRF, and if you control them, your XRF data is going to be much, much better. Going on to slide 22. So what are XRF supports? Well, we start at the bottom, the analytical sample support. As I said, it's the X-rays that pass through a window that's very small, maybe only a few square centimeters. It only penetrates to a 1 to 2 millimeter depth into the soil surface. So the instrument is actually seeing maybe 2 grams or less of a thin soil layer. Soil particle size and the way that it correlates to a metal concentration will determine how much metal is in the XRF field of view. If you have a particle that the XRF is seeing that has a really high metal concentration, it'll give you a really high result. But if you move it just a smidgen over where that particle is no longer in view, it might give you a very small result, a very much less concentrated result. Measurement support. For the XRF, the measurement support is the same as the analytical sample support because it sees total elemental content of the soil. There's no digestion or extraction involved. We go on to slide 23. So this is one of the differences between XRF and ICP that you need to keep in mind when you're trying to compare the two methods. ICP analysis requires the digestion of the soil mineral structure to free metals into solution, as we talked about before. And the common nitric acid digestion doesn't free all of those. But the XRF will see them because it looks at the total metals under its little window. If you were to try to get an ICP analysis that also saw all the metals in the minerals, like XRF would, you need to go to a hydrofluoric acid digestion. Hydrofluoric acid will digest all of the metal matrices and release all of the metals into solution. However, hydrofluoric acid digestion is difficult to do, and there's probably very few labs that do it. So getting it is difficult. But if you're really having trouble with comparing your ICP and your XRF data, and it's really important to figure out what's going on, doing a hydrofluoric acid digestion can be a way to get at understanding why there are these differences between ICP and XRF. Next slide is 24. So, how do we control XRF sample support? It makes the very small sample support that we talked about the order of 1 or 2 grams, makes it susceptible to these non-representative readings if you happen to get a rogue particle underneath the window. The more uniform the distribution of soil particles, obviously, the more precise the XRF readings will be. And again, uniformity depends on the adequacy of sample handling and preparation. Moving on to slide 25. Should we get a question?
Sure. If we can, before we jump into slide 25, let's answer some questions that have been submitted online. The first one is actually left over from our second break, and this is from Chicago, and they ask, how long did it take to grind one sample, and how many samples did you process?
Oh, I think I put it on the ball mill for like 15 minutes. How many samples did I process? Trying to remember, it was like 20. It took quite a while. One of the reasons it took a long time is I only had 2 cartridges. So after I ground one in the ball mill, I could load up another one, but then I had to wash everything in between. So if I had somebody helping me wash things, it would have gone a little faster. But, you know, taking care of glassware and those things is something you really have to factor in when you decide how long some of this stuff is going to take.
The next question comes in from Massachusetts. What other physical properties should we be concerned with besides particle size?
Sometimes organic carbon is an issue. The mineral structure, independent of particle size, the mineral structure might be important. If you've got iron or manganese oxides binding the iron, binding lead or arsenic, they actually are pretty easily digestible as opposed to other mineral matrices which don't give up the bound arsenic or lead nearly as easily. But any physical properties that seem to affect the results that you get, and those things are kind of unique to the matrices that you're working with. Obviously, sediments and soils have differences that will probably need to be looked at.
The next question comes in from Atlanta, Georgia. How is the spiking of a sample for the analyte of concern, how does it impact XRF testing and repeatability compared to, say, ICP? Is it even done?
It is sometimes done. The only time I've heard it done is actually for analyzing certain elements by XRF, such as uranium. Bob Johnson, are you on the phone? Do you want to address that?
Yes, I am. But I'm not sure that I have much to add to what you have, Dina.
I know you can spike it, but I guess it really needs to be ground pretty thoroughly to get that distributed.
I think part of the issues with spikes is this issue of digestion and extractability. In other words, you would expect much better performance in that regard from a spike sample than what you might expect from a natural soil sample. So that's something to be aware of.
Okay. And then the last question we have online, this is lab sample support part two. I assume most labs don't subsample, grind, and subsample again as you described. How much extra do labs charge for this enhanced level of QC?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know if they've ever been asked.
Yeah.
Excellent. And I know in the CLP program, very few labs would even have the equipment. Obviously, there are ones who do, but you might have to look around to find one that does have the equipment.
And then the last question submitted online comes in from Denver, Colorado. And they asked, does the EPA-approved method for XRF metal sampling include the sample preparations presented in these slides?
No. EPA methods are silent on the topic of sample prep. CLP methods, the same thing. They really don't say how to prep a sample or what even to think about to decide how to prep a sample. And the same thing for SW846 for XRF. Other than the fact that there is an allusion to the fact that sample prep can be important, there really is not a good discussion of the depths to which you really have to think about this issue and the depths to which it can cause you problems if you don't. There is good discussion in some of EPA's older guidances about dealing with soils. And those are some of the references that I want to take you to where they did a lot of early work on soils back in the early days of Superfund to try to understand what the impact of variability was. And unfortunately, because the handling it back then was so difficult using traditional laboratory methods, running a lot of replicates was difficult, the grinding equipment was difficult, sort of as a culture, we decided, it's the elephant in the living room. We don't want to deal with it. We can't afford to deal with it, so we're going to pretend it doesn't exist. Now that's different. We can handle it now, so it's time to bring this back to the forefront.
Just one last moment. Anyone on the phone lines have a question? You can ask it directly by pressing #6 to unmute your phone line. Okay, I guess we can continue on slide number 25.
Okay, sample handling and preparation. For XRF, you've got three main types of sample prep. And the effectiveness of all of these is influenced by how much effort and consistency the operator puts into the process. The better you can define the details in the QAP of what the operator should do, the better off you are. The three options for prepping soil for XRF is you can shoot XRF in situ, which means basically you shoot it on the ground or on a soil face. You can take shots over a bagged sample. So you put soil in a plastic bag, and then usually you squish it up and try to crush the aggregates so you have a fairly uniform matrix, and then take readings over the bag. And then the third way is by shooting a cup that contains highly prepared soils. When you're doing a cup, often they will dry and grind the sample and sieve it before putting it in a cup. And that's certainly the most labor-intensive way to take XRF readings, but you will get very good precision that way. Going on to slide 26. So we'll talk a little bit about the in-situ sample prep. The least preparation for in-situ is just shoot on the bare ground after maybe you brush the stones and some twigs away. You can do it that way, but if you just put a little effort into prepping the soil a little better, again, you will get better reproducibility and less likely to get real outlier results. And some of the easy but still important preparation you can do for in-situ shots is just loosen the soil to the depth of interest. Then pick out your grass, your stones, your twigs, maybe a few ants here and there. Try to crush the soil, especially if you're using like a metal spatula or a metal scoop. It's pretty easy to have your little loosened soil there and just crush the aggregates until it's uniform in appearance. Now, obviously, this really depends on what kind of soil you have. Some soils this will be easy with. Other soils, it's impossible. All these things are going to depend on what kind of matrix you're stuck with. And then smooth and compress the surface before placing your XRF. Your XRF should always be placed on a nice, as smooth a surface as possible so that you have good contact between the window and the soil. It's good to take several shots in the same prepared location. And if you reposition the XRF between shots, even if it's just, you know, pick it up and rotate it, it'll give you an idea of how much variability there is in that matrix and help you understand whether doing in-situ shots with a little bit of sample prep there on the ground, whether that's going to serve your purposes enough. If you go on to slide 27, we'll talk about the second option for preparing samples, which is using bagged samples. Now, with bag samples, people use different size bags. Some people use pretty small bags. Other people use gallon bags. And it's that idea of how big of a sample support do you need. If you have a lot of variability from samples that are close together, you know, just a foot or so apart, you might want a large sample support to keep from getting misled by the variability of grab samples. And if you remember from last week, I probably should have put that slide back in here to review, but the slide that shows the seven readings in the form of a wheel for TNT and how just 2 feet away you got a completely different answer than what you had on another grab sample. That's the kind of thing we want to avoid. We want to avoid getting misled by one of those small sample supports. So the larger the area that we can take, the more representative of the average our analysis is going to be. So taking a large bag is good. If you further prepared the sample outside of the bag, then putting a small amount in a bag is fine too. If you're putting material into a bag sort of raw, you know, you want to take out the sticks and the stones and the obvious stuff that doesn't belong there. One of the things you got to be careful of is trying to do too much crushing through the bag. If you have some hard aggregates or some little stones in there and you're really squishing down on it to break up the aggregates, it's unavoidable that you're going to create some dimples and puckers and stuff in the plastic bag. And that damages the smoothness of the bag, and it can introduce some variability into your XRF shots. If you're shooting through those kinds of dimples or puckers, it's possible that the X-rays can be deflected and it's going to give you an incorrect reading. So if you do squish through the bag, maybe reserve an area of the bag where there's no dimples, and then, you know, remix the soil between the shots into that non-dimpled area. Or you can mix in one bag and then transfer to another bag to do the readings. You know, whatever works for you, just try not to shoot through a part of the bag that's really dimpled. I mean, a little bit isn't going to hurt, but anything that's really, really been dimpled and creased is not, just not good practice. One thing you don't want to do is shake the bag. As you probably recall from the discussion last week, you know, when you take a soil sample in a jar and jiggle it through FedEx to the lab, it segregates. Well, you just shake the bag, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to cause segregation. So how can you mix it? Well, you can try sort of going end over end. Again, any kind of movement probably is not the greatest. It's very difficult to mix things by moving a bag around. You can try with your fingers, again, that sort of kneading to try to get things mixed up. But look at it visually and see. Do you see evidence visually that you've got segregation. You know, you look at one side of the bag and you see all little tiny particles against that wall of the bag, and you look on the other side of the bag and you see the big lumpy stuff. Obviously, that's a problem. Going on to the next slide, and this slide is a picture of some bagged XRF samples. And next slide. Next slide shows a bag, and again, in one of the older Niton XRFs, the little brick form shooting on the bag. Next slide. What's the benefits of bag samples? Well, when you're sampling from one location, the fact that you're taking a fairly large amount of soil, often you should be taking at least 300 grams. And again, some people are taking much more, and that's good. As I tried to show in that little example case study example illustration, you can actually do measures on, you know, take a smaller sample support and a larger sample support and see what differences there are, and see if that has any big effect on how many samples total you would need to do your project. You can also do multi-increment sampling with bag samples, and we'll discuss multi-increment sampling in one of the future modules of this series, and we'll go into it a great deal of detail, so I'm not going to do that here, but at this point, let's just say that doing multi-increment sampling is a way to greatly increase your sample support across the decision unit, but yet still keep the number of analyses that you need to do low. And the third bullet there, that we've used to very good effect, is taking multiple shots over the bag. One thing it does is it allows you to estimate how much within bag variability there is, which is part of which is particle size effects. If you take two readings on one side of the bag, turn it over and take two readings on the other side of the bag, are they pretty close together or are they all over the place? If we go to the next slide, slide 31. Of course, one of the benefits of using XRF is that you get the readings in real time. And that allows you to make adjustments so that you can ensure that you're getting data quality that's going to be useful for making decisions. You're not going to walk away from the site with still incomplete data sets that still can't give you the answers. You can follow this to the conclusion. If you're taking shots over your bag, and you find out there is a fair amount of heterogeneity in that bag, one thing you can do is increase the number of shots over the bag so that statistically you can control the heterogeneity and come up with a good estimate of the average for that bag. If it's still too high, an alternate is to knead the bag some more, crunch up some more of those aggregates, or look at the bag. Maybe there's paint chips in there. And that's what's causing a great deal of heterogeneity in your variability in your results. We actually had a project where that was the case. And what it comes down to is, you know, the paint chips are going to cause your data to bounce all over the place. You can sieve it to remove them, but if the paint's been there for a long time, some of those particles are down to dust size, and they're going to go through with the soil. So how do you decide at what point that they're part of the soil versus there's still paint chips that can be removed? It gets a little dicey. What we did in our project was the answer was there is paint chips in the yard. And we're not really sure exactly what the soil concentration is because the paint chips are causing the problem. But we are sure that those paint chips need to be removed so that the children in the yard aren't being exposed. Another benefit of bag samples, it's pretty inexpensive, and yet you can get really good results. And it supports the dynamic work strategy because you can get data of known and documented quality project that I worked on, the XRF operator was standing by his truck, and he was taking the readings from the bag and calling out the numbers to me, and I was entering it in a spreadsheet that was already set up to calculate the mean concentration and the 95th percent UCL. And if we found there was excess variability in the data, we just automatically increased the number of readings that were taken, or figured out that we needed to increase the number of bags that were taken from the yard to control for the heterogeneity that was at the short scale. Okay, moving on to slide 32, which is sample prep option number 3, and this is the XRF cups. And I should probably put in a picture of one of those. Didn't think of that. Hopefully most of you have seen what an XRF cup is. It's a little white plastic cup, holds maybe 5 grams of soil. To prepare a cup sample, you know, sort of the same thing, remove the debris, then you dry, grind, and sieve to get uniform particle size. And you place it in the XRF cup, and then you put a little film over the top and attach that with a ring to the cup, and then the XRF will shoot through that film to take a reading. They're very easy to use. Your NIST standard reference materials comes in those cups used from the vendor when you buy or rent an XRF. One thing to be careful of is the fact that even NIST samples that have been ground really well, you'd be amazed if you looked at it that you can still see variations in the particle size. And if you go tapping those cups, you will segregate some of those particle sizes. And it can cause variability in your results from one reading to the next, depending on how much mixing or tapping there was done in between readings. Again, always look at your sample before you read it and get an idea of what's happening with the particle sizes. And if you don't like the readings that you're getting, they're too variable, look at that variable and see if it's the particle sizes that are causing a problem. The cups give you the highest homogeneity of the samples or of the various sample prep methods, so it'll give you the best precision from reading to reading. And so it's the best way for determining method comparability between ICP and AA. If you're really looking to see how comparable the analysis is. Going on to slide 33. We're going into a slightly different section, so why don't we open the phone lines here and see if there's any questions about sample prep before we leave that.
The 3 that came in online.
Ah. Let's see, one question. Back to grinders. Is there any problems with grinders leaching contaminants such as chromium and iron? I know this is an issue, and if you were looking at analytes for which this is an issue, then obviously it needs to be addressed. And there's probably materials that could be used for grinders that are made of things that are not your target analytes. For lead, that's not an issue. Arsenic, it shouldn't be an issue. But chromium, certainly it might be. So that's a very good point, and it's something to be aware of. Next question, slide number 26. Is there any way to estimate a concentration from in-situ shots? Well, the instrument reports out a concentration. The issue is that sample support is really small. So it depends on estimating the concentration over what sample support do you want. You can take a high density of in-situ shots, and that will certainly give you a really good idea of how much variability is in an area and help you hone in on what the concentration is for a certain area. So I would say just increase the number of in-situ shots that you're taking. Increase the density. Another question, how does instrument response fall off with depth in in-situ samples? If I understand the question correctly, I think you're asking how far do the X-rays penetrate for in-situ samples, and it's not real far. It's only the 1 or 2 millimeters that it will penetrate for any XRF reading and swirl. So that definitely is something to think about. If you want to go to a deeper depth, you're going to have to expose the soil at that depth. It is very much a surface reading, should be considered that. Let's see, another question. You have used the phrase remove debris and stones. Down to what size are you removing rock? Do you recommend sieving in the field with sites that have high percentage of rock, such as glacial till? Well, again, it's one of those questions that needs to be dealt with on a site-specific basis. What do you consider representative? Goes back to your decision. Is this looking at dust exposure? Well, then obviously you're removing rock down to a very small size. Are you looking at a bulk sample? Well, you have to decide then. How big does the rock have to be before it's no longer representative of the information you're trying to gather?
So the other thing I would say to that is you're in a matrix like that, you're kind of stuck whether you're using XRF or the lab, because the lab is going to have similar issues if you send them a jar full of rocks with digestion. So I don't know if there's a rule of thumb in terms of particle size that you would remove to, but certainly placing an XRF in the in-situ mode on anything over really the size of less than a P or a BB is going to affect how the instrument receives the X-rays back, because you get scattering and the like. So when Dean was talking about the making a nice surface, we're really talking about kind of, you know, grinding what's available to the best you can in terms of the most powder-like you can get the matrix. So if you set the instrument in in-situ mode on top of something the size of a pea or larger, inevitably you're going to have back scattering. You're going to have hugely variable results. Now, like I said, the same issue is going to come to the lab if you send them a jar full of rocks. So in a matrix like that, as Dina said, it comes down to what is your decision. If your decision is related to the finer particles, i.e. a dust exposure scenario, then you're going to want to remove as many of those as you can and get down to the finer particles.
Another question, do you recommend one XRF over another, Niton versus Inovex or others? Oh, no. We work for the government. We never recommend one thing over another. We know folks who have done comparison studies basically just to find out which one meets their specific needs for a specific project. Each one will have certain strengths that maybe another one doesn't have, but I think they're fairly similar in their features. They're kind of in a development war right now, which is really good for us as a consumer, because they're constantly adding new things and improving other aspects of the technology, so we're the winners.
And the way that Bob usually answers that question when we get it, when we do this live delivery, is the best XRF is the newest XRF. Because the team said they're constantly trying and competing, they're going against each other, they're getting lower detection limits, they're adding features like direct upload, Bluetooth, and GPS components are now built into them. So we talk a lot about Niton and Inovex, because those are kind of the two most commercially available and widely used, but there's a whole series of other instruments out there, and they have a lot of the same features and direct comparability. I mean, you got to talk about, is it tube-based? Are you comparing a tube-based unit to a tube-based unit, or a radioisotope unit to a tube-based unit? So there's a whole host of issues, but in general, they all perform very similar and very well, particularly when you get into the newer units of the last several years and the tube-based systems.
Hi, it's Ken LaPerry here from ELM in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Our state requires frequently delineation below the water table, and due to our geology here, we oftentimes have to deal with extremely fine-grained matrices. I was wondering if you could amplify any thoughts to prepare in regarding preparedness for highly clay, highly silt, and or highly saturated soils.
Bob, do you want to address that, simply to give us a chance to rest our gums?
First of all, there's the water content issue. Water content can be an issue. If you read Method 6200, the recommendation there is to stay away from soils that have a water saturation greater than 20%. I think that realistically, the response of an XRF to moisture content is a function of element, and so you're going to see a bigger effect for some elements than what you do for others. And typically that's a function of the mass of the element you're going after. So the heavier the element, the less of an impact moisture content's going to have. But there's an easy way of getting at that question, and that is simply to take a sample of the media that you have an interest in, drying it thoroughly, taking a measurement on it with the XRF, or better yet, a couple of measurements, and then slowly re-wetting that sample, and after each re-wetting increment, reanalyzing it with the XRF. Without a lot of effort, you can quickly determine at what point soil moisture starts to impose an unacceptable effect on what you're doing. Second thing is with regard to soil moisture, is that an XRF response to increasing soil moisture is typically to underestimate how much of the element is there. So worst case scenario, you might have to build in some kind of safety factor, maybe 20% or 30% safety factor into your XRF result to compensate for the effects of soil moisture. And then the final comment about soil moisture is that you have to remember again that your XRF is only seeing the top 2 or 3 millimeters of soil. What that means is you don't have to dry a soil sample out thoroughly in order to do an XRF measurement. If you wanted to mitigate the effects of soil moisture, all you really need to do is get the surface of that sample dry. And that, you could do that by putting it under a heat lamp, for example. We've done that in the past. It's a fairly fast way of getting at least the surface of the sample dry enough to get a good measurement without having a lot of soil moisture complications. So those are the kinds of things you might want to consider when you're thinking about soil moisture. As regards to the fines and going after clays or whatever, there is a calibration issue there potentially. And the best way to simply get at that is to do, if you have the luxury, to do some comparability work where you're taking an XRF cup, measuring it, and then sending that cup off for ICP analysis and comparing the results and seeing if you have any kind of systematic bias that might be present because you're working with finer material than what the XRF has been calibrated for. An XRF can always be recalibrated to match the characteristics of the matrix you're after. That's also a relatively straightforward process. You would just need an appropriate calibration standard to run that XRF to be able to redo that calibration. I'm not sure if that answers your questions or not, but hopefully they do.
That's good. Thank you.
We have one more question that came in online from Denver, Colorado. They ask, is it necessary to use the longer analysis time with the XRF, 2 minutes versus 30 seconds?
We'll get into that.
Bob, do you want to take a quick shot at that, and then
I can take a quick shot. We're going to talk a lot more about that in some of the later modules, but just as a quick response, you can always determine, you should be able to determine what detection limit you're going to get for a particular measurement time with your XRF. It's a very predictable kind of function. As your measurement time increases, your detection limits will drop. So one quick answer to that is simply, what's your detection limit that you require? And given that detection limit, how long do you have to count to get to it? Now, there's a more complicated answer. I'm not going to get into that here because we'll talk about more of that in subsequent modules. But that's a simple answer to the question.
Okay. Does anyone on the phone lines have any last questions before we move on?
This is Randy McBride with Shaw Environmental in Knoxville. And I wanted to get back to the question or the comments that you made about the paint chips. And am I taking it to mean that you guys would recommend removing the paint chips prior to doing the analysis?
Well, if you're trying to get an analysis of the soil itself, you're going to want to try to remove as much of the paint chips as you can.
Okay. Well, I've personally had a lot of experience analyzing soils from pistol ranges and firing ranges, and we've come across this issue before where we've been criticized because we say that we remove bullets and bullet fragments from our samples prior to analysis. We just document their presence during the sample collection phase. Do you guys have any specific recommendations on how you need to respond to that criticism by saying that the removal of bullets actually causes a low bias of your analysis?
It's one of those things where I think what needs to be done is a lot more discussion of what exactly are we going to be using this information for and what exactly do we need to know. Again, if you know, I keep going back to this example because it's an easy one, but if the reason that you're doing this analysis on soil is because dust is blowing off site into the local neighborhoods, then that analysis does not involve the bullets or anything that's not going to blow around. It has to go back to what are you trying to demonstrate as to whether the bullets should be included or not.
There's also other considerations like reuse. You know, what is the property going to be reused as? Is it going to be redeveloped as, home sites, or are they going to put a daycare center on there, or those sorts of things? Those exposure scenarios figure into it. And then ultimately remedy implications, too, because, you know, what are you thinking about in terms of remedy? Are you going to potentially, screen the soils and remove large bullet fragments? And that's going to, you don't want to have those fragments in your sample analysis as being representative of what of the remedy or what the material that would be left after the remedy, because you plan to remove those larger fragments.
Yeah, if there's a question about that, it's because the planning up front was not thorough enough to make it clear.
I mean, from a strict analytical standpoint, we've always approached it as what we're trying to do is analyze the concentration of lead in soil, not the concentration of lead in bullets.
Right.
Therefore, we're removing those bullets as, not representative of the actual sample matrix.
Right. But it never hurts to communicate that with whoever the data is going to be going to beforehand, before you collect it, so that they understand that that's the data that they're going to be getting. And then if they have a different expectation, then at least you can talk about it and come to a resolution before they get the data and then decide there's a problem.
One other comment about the bags, I just wanted to say, has anybody talked about on a pre-printed, like a Ziploc bag, analyzing the sample that is, or analyzing with the XRF on the side that's not printed versus the side that is printed?
I don't remember that ever coming up.
Because, a printing process could interfere with, the X-ray process, I would think.
Yeah, I would think that's a possibility. It's always good to be safe.
Yeah, in general, we try to use bags that don't have those printing issues, and also we did an evaluation of different kinds of bags. Dina and I did some work, and there's certain bag manufacturers that actually have little ribs in them, and we found that there were some issues with those in terms of scattering X-rays. So you want to try to shoot through. I mean, obviously you want to do random shots across the bag when you're looking at averaging, but you don't want to bias your shots in any way by shooting through printed areas or, as Dina mentioned, dimpled areas or things of that nature that can actually just cause greater variability in your results. So if you can stay away from those types of bags and those types of things, it's nice to do.
If there's any doubt, it's fairly easy to do a little study. Take the bag in question and shoot through it. Put it like over a NIST cup and shoot through it. You can also like create layers so that, if you have a layer of plastic that's, maybe hold it over so that there's six layers there and you still don't see any difference, then I'm sure shooting through one layer is not going to cause a problem.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the NIST standards and the QC stuff, but that is an easy fix. Is you have a known concentration for your standard reference materials that we'll talk about in the QC module and the DMA module. And so if you have an issue about the material that you're shooting through, if you place that over the NIST standard and then assess the variability, you get some determination of what the impact of that is.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, in the interest of time, let's keep going.
Okay, we're on slide 33. And this is just a little figure to reinforce the idea that data quality is a function of a lot of factors, and we're used to thinking only about the analytical side of it, but we really need to start thinking about the sampling side, because that is where so much of the variability in data comes from when you're dealing with heterogeneous solids, such as sediments and soils and such. So the data quality chain has a lot of links to it, and I'm not going to read through all the little boxes, but the point being that if any of those links are broken, even if just one is broken, everything downstream is suspect. Doesn't matter how good your analytical method is, if you've started out with a non-representative sample, you're not going to get good data, no matter how good the analysis is. Next slide is slide 34. And I promised you last week that you'd see this slide again. This is a slide that shows the relationship between the variability in data results compared to the sample support. That as sample support gets smaller and smaller, the variability that you can get gets larger and larger. Now, this also has a big implication for making decisions. If someone is trying to make decisions based on a reading by reading basis, we're going to go to slide 35 and see what can happen with that. Under the topic of variability in the single data point, the point of this slide is to show that if you have a large sample support, say there where I have the arrow going down to the in situ sodium iodide reading, and which means that you have less variability in your data, if the action level there is 100 at the red line, and my true mean is around, maybe that was set at 20, the true mean is around 20. Even with the variability in the data, probably the maximum result you're going to get is around 50. So you don't have to worry about exceeding your action level when your true mean is around 20, because with the sample support that the sodium iodide detector sees is large enough that the data is pretty tight around the mean. On the other hand, and we'll go to the next slide, which is slide 36. In this case, our sample support has now dropped to about 400 grams, which is kind of the standard sample volume. And remember, when we talk about sample support, the assumption is that that entire volume is being read. So even though you sent 400 grams, say, to the laboratory, the result on the sample support assumes that the laboratory has ground the sample to a uniform matrix before analysis, or by some magical method has analyzed the entire 400 grams at once. So but even so, you get a lot of variability caused by that size sample support. Even 400 grams allows a maximum reading to go up to about 200 ppm, which means that if your action level is 100 ppm, at least some of the results will exceed the action level, purely by random chance. A lot of them will be below the action level, but a few will be above, and that's solely a function of what is the volume of soil that we're analyzing. go on to slide 36. I'm sorry, slide 37. So, with this, these issues in mind, the amount of variability that you get, can XRF provide definitive data? This is a question that comes up because so many times people say, well, XRF's okay, but it's only good for screening. Well, if we go back to the definition of definitive data, and I think, again, I mentioned this in part one, the Superfund guidance for data quality objectives says that for data to be definitive, either analytical or total measurement error must be determined. Now, you measure that error by taking multiple replicate analyses and analyzing the precision. If you try to do this in a laboratory, obviously you're increasing your analytical costs to get those repeated analyses in order to calculate the amount of variability. However, XRF is unique because you can take multiple readings on the same thing, the replicates, and it's non-destructive, there's no consumables. Mainly what you have, especially if you're using like a bag, you're adding some labor and minutes to it, but it's very inexpensive to take those replicate readings, which allows you to determine the error in each step of the process. You can determine the error for the instrument itself. You can determine the error for very short-scale heterogeneity, you know, where you just take the XRF and take a shot and then rotate it over the matrix so it's seeing just a slightly different particle size set and get an estimate of the variability there. If you're working in situ, you can take a shot at one point and then a foot away you can take shots and get an estimate of the variability at that spatial scale. It's very easy with XRF to understand where your error is coming from, which is causing the most error in your data set, and then be able to control for that error. So I would argue that XRF can provide definitive data, according to Superfund's definition, even better than many fixed lab analyses can. If we move on to slide 38. So this is a summary of how we can reduce XRF variability. We can reduce the analytical variability, that is the variability that is due to the instrument itself, by increasing the count time or using a newer instrument. We can reduce the sample handling variability by better homogenization of samples, doing something that's called aggregate readings, which will be covered again in a future module by Bob Johnson. At this point, what aggregate readings means is that you take very, very short shots, maybe only 10-second shots, but those results of those short shots are aggregated together, and it allows you to control spatial variability, but at the same time get the lower detection limits you would have gotten if you had taken a single reading for a long time, like 120 seconds. Another way to reduce sample handling variability is to make sure that you're handling samples consistently from one to the next. And that involves proper training of staff and proper procedures, SOPs, that are part of the work plan. And then sampling variability, taking more readings per sample, like if you have a bag and there's a lot of variability in the bag, you can take more readings on that bag to control for variability and still get a good estimate of the average for that bag. Or you can increase the number of bags that you take from a decision unit, or increase the number of in situ shots across the decision unit. And then another way to handle sample variability is that increasing sample support, which can be done by either taking larger volumes of soil when you take a grab sample or using multi-increment sampling to achieve that larger sample support. Going on to slide 39. So controlling heterogeneity in a field lab or a field trailer, you can have the possibility of doing a thorough preparation of drying your sample, homogenizing it, and grinding it. But that's usually pretty labor-intensive and equipment-intensive and power-intensive for if you're just doing a quick field study. So generally you're going to be relying on the type of sample prep that you can do in the field, whether it's at least a minimal grinding in a mortar and pestle, if crushing in a bag isn't useful, or aggregating readings over a bag. And Bob, do you want to say a few words about aggregating readings at this point, just to make sure it's clear, even though we'll discuss it in greater detail later on?
We will be talking about it much more in subsequent modules. Just a quick point. Some XRF instruments can be set up to automatically do aggregate readings. I think this is true with both Intevax and Niton units in the sense that if you set it properly, you can take multiple readings, and then the XRF will report the average result after those readings have been collected. The only thing you have to be careful with that is that the error the XRF calculates and its reported detection limit aren't correct, and so you want to watch out for that. The other way of doing aggregate readings is to take those readings individually, then download the data to a spreadsheet, and do the aggregate or averaging process there within a spreadsheet to get the result that you're after. But we'll be talking a lot more about how that gets done and the pros and cons and why one would do it, what one would watch out for in later modules.
Thank you, Bob. Slide number 40. When we talk about multi-increment sampling, we always get the question of how many increments. So I'm just warning you, it'll be talked about in Module 6. And we're to slide 41, which is our last Q&A session. We're at the end of the module.
So anyone who's on the simulcast or listening online, feel free to use that orange question mark icon to submit your questions now. For those of you on the phone lines, you can feel free to unmute by pressing #6 and go ahead and speak up, state your name or your location, and ask us your questions. We have about 15 minutes left for Q&A. Well, it looks like you guys have done another stellar job. We had almost 200 participants actually today, international people from Canada as well as Brazil joining us on the seminar. So we had a great audience today, lots of questions from the group. As with the other seminars in this particular series, any questions that we don't address today, you can continue to contact the instructors by email or submit them using the question mark icon, and we will follow up and have time at the next session, session number 4, which is scheduled to take place this Thursday at the same time, and we'll address those remaining questions at the next session in this 8-part seminar series on XRF. Is that someone on the phone line? Well, I don't see any questions coming in online, and I don't hear anyone speaking up on the phone line, so we can wrap things up. I'd ask everyone to move ahead to slide number 42, which is the last PowerPoint presentation slide in today's event. There are two very important links here. The first one is the link to additional resources, and that's where you'll find some guidance documents, the website, some of the links to references like that Dina mentioned earlier. The other link on this page on slide 42 is our feedback form, and we would appreciate it if you could take just a moment or two to fill out some basic questions about how the seminar went, what the quality of the delivery was, what you thought of our instructors. If you'd like to see more like this, or if there's anything we could do to improve it, we do read these and we do take them into account. On that feedback form, you'll also have an option if you'd like to have a confirmation email sent to you for your records, you can. For those of you who are looking for CEUs or PDHs, sometimes that confirmation email helps with trying to keep your records for training purposes. So if you get feedback, you do get a confirmation email. I see some compliments, so we did a good job. We appreciate that feedback. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you. Looks like we have a question that came in online from Massachusetts. Last one of the day. If using a bag, can you have the bag open to shoot the readings?
I guess you could. I don't know why you'd want to.
Okay. All right. Again, you can continue to keep submitting those questions. You can go to the seminar homepage and contact any of our instructors by email. We'll follow up with leftover questions starting this Thursday at the next, at the session 4 of this 8-part series on XRF. So thanks, everyone, and hope you have a great morning or afternoon, depending on your time zone. Take care.